Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Time is short, so few words from me. A doubleheader of New School faculty today, though purely by coincidence. In moments we'll hear from Sean Jacobs, who will talk about Fidel Castro and Cuba's relationship with Africa. And then at the bottom of the hour, Cinzia Uruzza will talk about lessons of the Berlusconi years as we face the Trump years. The death of Fidel Castro sent the cliché machine into overdrive in the U.S., launching all sorts of Cold War epithets in large quantity. One angle that was undercovered, the entirely good things that Castro and Cuba did for Africans. Here's Sean Jacobs, an assistant professor of international affairs at the New School in Manhattan. In the second half of the interview, Sean gives his perspective on the student movement in South Africa, a topic we first covered on Behind the News in early November. Sean Jacobs. There have been a lot of gallons of ink and millions of pixels spilled over the death of Fidel. But one angle that people haven't really talked about very much, and you did, is how it felt in Africa and the relation that Cuba developed with that continent. In your piece, you said growing up when you did, Fidel meant that he was fighting for your freedom, right?
Mm-hmm. To many people in the West, you know, there's a certain caricature, particularly in the United States, around Fidel Castro and Cuba, in which Cuba is reduced to Fidel. And so all the things that people might assume are excesses are highlighted. Media repression, repressing of dissidents, discriminating against gays and people living with HIV or people who have AIDS. Even though some of those things, they happened for a certain period, they didn't happen the whole of Fidel's reign as president or leader of Cuba. Cuba legalized or ended discrimination of gay people, I think, by the end of the 1970s. So there's a lot of things in which people flatten out the history of Cuba and Fidel. You know, as I said, they reduce it to the worst excesses, and they
over-idealize the how the West was behaving in those same
right. Things. So they write about Castro and Cuba in this very sort of one-dimensional way. And just repeating right-wing talking points, millions, he killed millions. And I think somebody mentioned the Batista regime killed in the tens of thousands. And at best, and this is not to excuse the killing of anybody, the Cuban regime over a 40-year period most probably executed 500 people. There's a way in which, a lot of the actions of the Cuban regime is it's pushed or talked about out of proportion with the facts. It doesn't gel with the facts. And then as I was writing in the piece, a great irony also about the reaction to Castro is that many of the same people who demand acknowledgement of his wrongs, they don't acknowledge that their governments were on the wrong side of history, sponsored dictatorships in many developing countries, and they never own up to this stuff. So you get somebody like Otto Reich, his role in Central and South America. I think he was an assistant Secretary of State under Reagan or Bush. We don't hear about the Contras. We don't hear about destabilization of the government of Venezuela or various governments in South America. If you look at the and we're talking here about sort of foreign policy and particularly a certain notion of internationalism, whereas the U.S. has a very selfish notion of internationalism, what is in its interest. Fidel Castro, and my preamble was to talk about his domestic policy and how complicated that was. I think if in time, if history will judge him, then when it came to foreign policy, his was a more altruistic foreign policy, and especially for Africans. And what I was writing about is you can go as far back as the Algerian revolution against France, when after the murder of Lumumba by a conspiracy of the West, local elites, and which is the United States, Britain, and Belgium, he sent Che Guevara to go and oppose Mobutu. Later, they played a role in the freedom of Guinea-Bissau and Cabo Verde with Amilcar Cabral. And for me, especially, in the fight against apartheid in South Africa. So I was just trying to remind people that, look, it's a much more complex history than this kind of one-dimensional history that we're getting about him here in the U.S.
What were you aware of growing up in South Africa? What was your image of Cuba that you you absorbed in your younger years?
I'm sort of a child of the like late 1970s, early 1980s, which coincided with South Africa's version of like a war on terror, and a war on terror against people who were trying to implement, you know, forms of democratic rule in South Africa, to end apartheid, to end racism, to end white power rule. And also South Africa was trying to prevent those people who were hiding out, say, in camps in Angola. They were exiles in Lesotho, in Botswana. These are neighboring countries in Southern Africa, in Mozambique. And South Africa would, like, almost like the way you have killers now, they would go in through these forces called recce forces. These are kind of like special forces, and would go and murder people, bomb housing, especially of where exiles are living in these neighboring states. And to some extent, the South Africans had the upper hand. They also occupied Namibia. They would regularly invade Angola. So Angola had just gotten independence from Portugal. It was very weak. There was another force in Angola called UNITA, which was funded variously by the Chinese, but particularly it was funded by the United States. He becomes a character in that story. And they were funded by apartheid South Africa. As you grow up, you hear these kind of heroic stories about how Cuba comes to the aid of the Angolans. And in the process, they defeat the South African army in various battles, 1976, leading up, I think, up until the late 1980s, that eventually leads to the independence of Namibia. So when you're growing up with this, you know, and again, I know that I'm operating here with sort of extremes. You got like a very repressive regime that is lying about its activities in the region, but news filters through about what is happening in Angola, what is happening in Namibia. You hear that it's the Cubans that are coming. Mandela said the West came for the scramble in Africa, but here is a country that came to help us. They didn't come to take stuff from us. So that's kind of like how I experienced that as a teenager. I didn't experience it. In hindsight, of course, I have a much fuller story. I have more detail. But at the time, I experienced it very much as like these heroic Cubans, not with the intent, with an eye on resources and oil and this and that and the other, but with a real political commitment to come and help liberate, like in Fidel Castro's words, their brothers and sisters in Southern Africa.
Now, what was the relation of the Cuban actions in Angola to the eventual end of apartheid?
As I was saying, the Cubans defeated the South African army in a very famous battle. It's called the Battle of Quito Canavale in the late 1980s. Up until that point, the South African army, which was seen as a very formidable army, was you know, they were victorious in all their battles in the region. They would invade, as I said, Namibia. They somehow were very successful in repelling the ANC, which didn't have such a great armed struggle at that time. So defeating the South African army made the South Africans pause for a minute. And then that began like a series of negotiations that starts with the independence of Namibia. Namibia at that point is a colony of South Africa. South Africa had invaded it after the First World War. And that then eventually then leads, as you know, to the South African government beginning to negotiate with the ANC. That negotiation is leading to the release of Nelson Mandela.
And of course, the U.S. was on the wrong side of every one of these struggles.
Yeah, but they don't write about it that way. One of the sort of ironies of these kind of, you know, writing with hindsight or with the lack of reflection, I think, in the U.S., always paint the U.S. as this beacon for democracy and human rights in the rest of the world. But when you look at just the African continent, the U.S. propped up not just, you know, in the case of the alliances with the Portuguese, or in the case of Congo, which is next to Angola, the Mobutu regime from like 1965 until 1997, propping up that regime, apartheid South Africa through the 1970s, through the 1980s, using terminology like constructive engagement, Reagan's comment about our kith and kin, or our natural allies in South Africa, and couching it as anti-communism. And one of the things that I wrote in one of the pieces, but it didn't make it to the final edit, is also how Mandela's comment about, well, who are these people who are trying to tell us about Cuba, because they supported the apartheid regime. When he said this in 91, they supported apartheid for the last 40 years. No honorable man or woman could ever accept advice from people who never cared for us at the most difficult times. it's also like interesting that up until 2008, Nelson Mandela was still on a U.S. terrorist watch list. In this everyday screaming about Fidel Castro, with the hysteria about Fidel Castro and the lack of nuance, is that people don't look at actual history to understand, like, you know, the U.S.'s very destructive role in the region.
Well, of course, then Mandela, now his reputation is sanitized looking backwards, and he gets, you know, sainthood, although the days when he was a terrorist are written out of history.
Various different people started claiming Mandela, I think, when he was in old age, in order to, like, sanitize these political measures. Like, one of the projects I actually want to do is something called Radical Mandela, where you can go back and you can see that Mandela actually did believe in not in an armed struggle just for the sake of it, but as a last resort. He had a very radical vision of what South Africa had to become as a nation. He wanted to chart a very independent foreign policy that was not necessarily the foreign policy of, you know, the U.S. after the Cold War, but something where South Africa would come up with its own idea of how to chart a way through the world. And that meant, you know, having alliances with places like Cuba. And this one other small point also, one of the other problems with debating Castro and Cuba in the U.S., two things. One is, like, the idea that Castro was still running Cuba is, I think, the one part of the argument. And I think the second one is the sense that's created that Cuba operated in some kind of, it was a closed society throughout this period. No, actually, Cuba maintained very normal relations with large parts of the world, with countries in the Caribbean, with countries in South America, even with Canada. And very little of that comes out. Because it's the most powerful country in the world, did not have relations with Cuba. The assumption is created, you know, this country is a pariah, but it's, you know, the rest of the world did not have the same relationship with Cuba.
Now, I interviewed someone a few months ago, who Rachel Price, who'd written a book about art in Cuba, and it was very clear that Cuban artists were following developments in the art world globally. You know, they were not the isolated population living behind a wall that American propaganda would have us believe.
No, and there's enough scholarship and enough work about, say, for example, the relationship between Haiti and Cuba, Jamaica and Cuba. Mexico has had a robust relationship with Cuba, I mean, dating back to the Castro's defeat of Batista. You know, Castro goes into exile in Mexico. Mexico had diplomatic relationship with Cuba throughout this whole period, this whole difficult period of the 1970s or the 1980s. Even just as a South African, there's a writer from Cape Town who's very dear to me, Alex Laguma. He's buried in Cuba. There's just, you know, training medical doctors. I mentioned in the piece, post-Cold War, the role of Cuba in the Ebola crisis. They supplied the bulk of the medical personnel alongside Africans and, you know, Medicine Sans Frontières and various other NGOs to deal with that crisis, while the U.S. was kind of doing a lot of PR, releasing all kinds of statements of building hospitals and so on, and never doing that. A lot of that never comes out in the writing around Cuba in the U.S.
I'm speaking with Sean Jacobs, who's an associate professor of international affairs at the New School in New York, and now switching a bit to contemporary South Africa. I had a guest on a few weeks ago to talk about the student movement there, and you also have some perspectives. So, well, first, remind us what this student movement has been all about over the last year or so.
The South African student movement, the current iteration of it, you can date it back to in March of 2015, when students who studied at universities that historically were white universities or liberal universities, these are the sort of elite campuses in South Africa. They used to be very white, but the student body had changed dramatically over the last decade or so. And the ANC government, and I think this is an important point, should take credit for that, creating through bursary schemes, putting pressure on universities to become more accessible to black students to enter the university. But the universities in itself, they remained like the structure of the universities, like many of the people running the universities, the professors, etc., the curriculums were still very white. And there were also very visible symbols on these campuses, images of white supremacy or images that reminded people of apartheid and colonialism. And at the University of Cape Town, which is one of these universities, there was a statue of Cecil John Rhodes, who was a very violent figure from the late 19th century in South Africa, and who's a key figure in colonialism, the beginnings of the mining labor system in South Africa, the expansion by British Empire into Southern and East Africa, you know, a very pivotal figure. So there's a statue of Cecil John Rhodes that sits sort of, the University of Cape Town is on a hill, and the statue is a very imposing statue. It almost looks like Cecil John Rhodes sits at the top of on the side of the mountain where the university is, and he looks out over, you know, the peninsula, because in Cape Town is like a sort of massive peninsula. And a group of black students decided that they had had enough of this. So they one of them, he did an act, which I think is a very spectacular act, because students had been saying, you know, remove the statue, this is racist, we want it to go. He took a bucket of shit. Some people said he brought it from a nearby township where people don't have actual toilets. And there's a separate struggle around sanitation by poor black people in cities like Cape Town, where they actually use that tactic of bringing this and throwing it at the doorstep of like the local legislature. So what he did was he poured this on the statue. This act sort of galvanized all the other students on the campus. This eventually led to the statue being removed. At the same time, these students then, you know, they begin to use words like decolonizing the university. So this then spread to other campuses. And the pivotal ones is the University of Witwatersrand, or WITS, which is the big university in Johannesburg. You know, it's a big intellectual space, but it also has a really big engineering program that's tied to the mining industry. And then the other university is called Rhodes University, as you can imagine, named for Cecil John Rhodes, in the Eastern Cape, in a town called Grahamstown. So these students begin to, like, suddenly make, you know, a lot of noise around this issue of decolonizing the university. Now, they weren't always very specific about what that meant, but they did say things like, we want to end patriarchy, issues around sexuality, issues around identity, curriculum, etc. There was a separate struggle that happened at historically black universities. Now, this is not, the historically, to call these universities historically black universities and think about them in the way that they operate in the United States is a bit of a misnomer, because these universities were created by apartheid as separate universities for black students, but it was done on this very like ethnic basis, you know, like the University of the Zululand for Zulus, the University of the North for, you know, people who live in what is now the Limpopo province, the University of the Western Cape for colored students. So this was like ethnic universities for black students. On those campuses where they don't have the kind of resources they have at the white universities, there had been longer struggles around access to housing, real sort of bread and butter issues of being a student, and there were struggles around the outsourcing of workers. The outsourcing of workers had also happened at WITS and at UCT, and somehow some of the people on those campuses, they kind of made those connections. And so a national struggle around symbols and also on outsourcing began to develop. That struggle then took what I thought was a really interesting and exciting turn, when by sort of the second half of 2015, they begin to make a connection to the question of like free public higher education. Now they in South Africa, they framed it in this phrase called fees must fall. So they literally said like, we would like, you know, free public higher education in South Africa. And they led this march to the capital, Pretoria, to the equivalent of the South African White House, it's called the Union Buildings, in a massive protest by all these students. And the President Jacob Zuma, he met with student leaders. But at the end of that night, he announced that there would be no fee increases for the next year. He didn't say there would be no fees. He just said no fee increases. So that was considered like a political victory for these students. In South Africa, the school year ends like sort of October, November, and people then go on like a long summer break, and they come back at the beginning of February. Most people thought, okay, what this movement would do was they would take this break and then hopefully they would come back in the new year and they would kind of unite around this question of fees. You know, a national movement could be built, connections could be made to the trade union movement, connections could be made with these other struggles in the townships around kind of decent housing. So, you know, a national movement around the disquiet with the ANC and with the post-apartheid settlement. So in their rhetoric, most of these things were happening, but I think also the movement began to sort of split. around different kind of factions that were close to the ANC, other factions that called for like a way more radical politics that involved a lot of burning of things, burning of libraries, burning of even at the University of Cape Town, there was the place with the statue. There was a lot of burning, like sort of wanton violence, I think, became part of it. Some people argued that that was a strategic politics for some of these groups. My sense is like in this year, in 2016, the promise of 2015 that was there, that seemed, you know, there was a possibility of like the building of a national student movement. People thought, okay, this movement could maybe grow into like the equivalent of a national union of students, the kind of thing you see in Britain or that you saw in Chile around free education developing. It didn't. And small groups, I think, of really hardline students began to take over these movements and alienated most other students. So 2016 was mostly a series of disruptions on campuses. There was also something which I found very interesting, in which the students, their claim was that they wanted to win over the vice chancellors, which is the equivalent of a president of a university, to their struggle. But their reaction to these people were quite hostile. The new presidents of most of the universities come out of the liberation struggle. Many of them are black, but for some strange reason, they and the students never could combine to take on the state, you know, to use the state as a target to demand this free education. So right now, a number of these universities have been closed. Some of them are open. There's occasional disruption. But my sense is, and I think I have a very harsh critic, and again, I'm speaking from afar, but I somehow feel that an opportunity was lost to begin to dream for a new kind of politics in South Africa, especially when the ANC, the sense is that the ANC's project has sort of run aground and run out of steam, and it's clear that the ANC was not going to deliver on the promises. It would decolonize South Africa, and it would create another kind of South Africa. And my last point is, I think in that space where the student movement did not make those connections to the trade union movement, and what was there was some excitement around the kind of workers' party. I think that space has been taken by groups like the Economic Freedom Front, which is a much more populist movement that makes, you know, that does the language of the left, but is a more sort of populist movement around like symbols and dress. And with still, again, the reliance on like a sort of charismatic leader when there was a possibility to build something more democratic.
We only have a minute or two left, but what happened to make that turn?
I think I'm pretty harsh about this. Identity politics won that round. I have time for identity politics, but I often feel that there's a sense in which, and this is, you know, this is present also here in the U.S. It's very interesting how the politics of, like, you know, breaking politics down into smaller groups, each and everyone with their own kind of specialized demands, took the space of demanding something broader. It became about, like, who's more pure, who has the real message. That defeated what could have been an interesting movement. For me, this is quite disappointing, given the history of popular movements in South Africa. There is a long history of building these cross-class, cross-racial alliances and pushing those movements, even if they started out in a kind of center-left or using the politics of human rights, but pushing them to the left. You know, you can think of the movements of the 1950s in South Africa with the so-called Charter Movement. You can think of the 1980s with the United Democratic Front. And then there's like smaller iterations, like in the early 2000s with the Anti-Privatization Forum, the electricity crisis, the anti-eviction, you know, the AIDS movement in South Africa. There are models for building these alliances across these various identities and having a sort of left orientation to the kind of politics. But I think what's happened now is a certain kind of purity that's very much a kind of Pan-Africanist, a very sort of rabid black nationalist politics has taken over in these movements. And unfortunately, it's to the detriment of, I think, building another kind of mass politics in South Africa.
Oh, Sean Jacobs, an assistant professor of international affairs at the New School in New York. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Shostakovich's Prelude No. 2 for piano, performed by Vladimir Ashkenazy. Almost everyone listening to this show is probably feeling a high degree of dread as the inauguration of Donald Trump approaches. Many are urging us not to normalize him, choosing to emphasize instead his quasi or proto or crypto-fascist tendencies, a line supported by an almost pornographic interest in his gross personality. This may be a political mistake. Cinzia Uruzza, an assistant professor of philosophy at the New School, wrote a fine essay for the Verso website on what the Italian experience of Berlusconi might mean for those of us looking to fight Trump. She is also the author of Dangerous Liaisons, Marriages and Divorces of Marxism and Feminism, published by Merlin in 2013. Cinzia Uruzza. I had forgotten, until I read your article on the Verso blog the other day, just how long Berlusconi has been around. He had his first taste of power in 1994, correct?
Exactly. Yeah, this was the first election he won.
What brought him to power? People are talking about the similarities with Trump. There are similarities, but also differences. So let's talk about the origin, the political origin of Berlusconi's regime.
So this actually is a very specific Italian story in the sense that Berlusconi managed to gain power because of the collapse of the old political and party system, because of the scandals concerning political corruption. So this produced the disintegration of the former Christian Democratic Party that was the ruling party in Italy for 40 years, more or less. And of course, this created a vacuum, a political space that he managed to occupy. What he did is, was to agitate also a form of, at the beginning, of soft populism. And there are some similarities with Trump, but also some relevant differences. So, for example, he did insist on his entrepreneurial success, on his inexperience with the political establishment, as actually not only a mark of purity, but the possibility of, you know, ruling the country in a different way, in a successful way, and so on. And this probably appealed to people. But there are also significant differences because he had the monopoly of the private information in Italy, the TV channels.
And how did he use those channels? Did he use them as advertisements for himself, frankly?
Absolutely. So this was one of the really recurrent problems in Italy in this 20 years, in the sense that Berlusconi had the property of three main private TV channels, and he used them at each and every election as a platform for his electoral campaign. And the problem is that even when the center-left was in government, they never really passed a law on conflict of interest that would have prevented Berlusconi from actually doing this. So he did consistently use his media presence. And his media empire is not just the TV, it's also, you know, publishing companies, a number of magazines, and so on. And everything was mobilized in support of his campaign. So this is a relevant difference with Trump, because actually Trump had most of the press against him.
You mentioned the Christian Democrats had fallen apart because of corruption scandals. What happened to the traditional parties of the left?
There was a process of decomposition and recomposition of the left, because the former Communist Party dissolved and gave birth to a new Social Democratic Party, let's say. that then evolved into a democratic party. And then part of the former Communist Party created a new communist leftist party together with what remained of the new left of the 70s and 60s. So there was a moment of recomposition, let's say, redefinition of the left scene, but with the move to the right, because the transformation of the Communist Party into the PDS, Partito dei Democratici di Sinistra, actually was also a move, a more decisive move towards neoliberalism.
Basically, we're talking about a scene where the traditional political structures had pretty much collapsed. There was a large vacuum, and Berlusconi, with his larger-than-life style, moved into the vacuum.
Exactly. So this is what happened.
There are also some personality similarities, aren't there? Like, it's a bit of a clown, a frankly misogynist
yes.
character. There are considerable stylistic similarities between the two, correct?
Yeah, these are actually the greatest similarities, in the sense that Berlusconi became increasingly politically incorrect. It was less so in 1994, but then he realized that actually political incorrectness did work in communicative terms. He was straightforwardly racist and misogynist, although his misogyny was of a different, slightly different kind from Trump, in the sense that Berlusconi really had this fantasy, in my view, of being a great seductor. So he would have not joked about, you know, forcing women to have sex. But he actually did have an harem, basically. So he used his own position of power and his money to actually have a harem that he even made accessible, available to, you know, his political entourage, but also guests from other countries and so on. And increasingly, he also used an anti-establishment language, let's say. This actually increased over the course of the years. So he was also somebody who really liked, you know, making very gross jokes. He was pretty famous for this. So these are actually really elements of similarity, also, you know, a certain kitschy aesthetics that they share in common.
This seems to be a common feature of many of these authoritarian characters, is that they come off as clownish. Intellectual and political elites don't take them seriously. They get mocked, but that, if anything, only adds to their appeal to a certain portion of the population, correct?
Exactly. And by the way, something actually significant is the fact that the continuous insistence on these aspects of Berlusconi never really worked in terms of anti-Berlusconi campaign, in the sense that I think one element has to do with the fact that this form of communication creates the fantasy and the illusion of identification of also popular sectors in the candidate. In other words, by being politically incorrect and making gross jokes and so on, somehow these political politicians present themselves as, in a sense, close to the people, while, of course, they are absolutely not. They're actually straightforwardly capitalist, in the sense they have their own capitalist companies. But there was a misunderstanding, I think, in concerning the appeal of this kind of rhetoric for certain sectors of the population. And let's say that the elitist, scandalized response from the liberal left in Italy was never really effective in stopping this. Actually, it even made the problem worse.
Berlusconi's first attempt at government was not successful, correct? He fell after, what, 9 months?
Yes, more or less 7-8 months.
What prompted the fall?
Two main factors. Clearly, the political system, parliamentary system in Italy is very different from the American one. So Berlusconi had, in order to have the majority in the parliament, had to ally with other right-wing parties. The two main right-wing parties were the Northern League, that was and is a federalist xenophobic party in the north, and a neo-fascist, an evolution of the neo-fascist party, Movimento Sociale Italiano, that is Alleanza Nazionale. And these two parties were actually, in a certain sense, incompatible, because one was precisely a neo-fascist nationalist party and the other was a federalist one. The Northern League decided to withdraw its parliamentary support to the government, to break with the government, out of several reasons. So one was the failure of Berlusconi to carry on federalist reform. And another problem was the attempt by Berlusconi to reform the pension system.
When you say federalist, do you mean devolving some powers towards the regions and away from the central government?
Devolving some powers, and especially fiscal federalism. Devolving, for example, the management of public health care to the regions, according to a principle of fiscal federalism, which means that then richer regions would basically keep their money there.
The Northern League just appealed to that perpetual distaste for subsidizing the South.
Exactly. Exactly. And by the way, in the first years of its political success, the Northern League was more focused on racism against Southern Italy rather than xenophobia. And only in the last 10 years, it shifted from, let's say, focusing on the South to focusing on migrants.
Okay, and you mentioned the pension reform, and he failed at that. And when, of course, when people say pension reform, they basically mean cutting pensions, right?
Yeah, it was not only cutting pension, but it was also the introduction of the contributory system, which didn't exist in Italy because the system was based on redistribution. Berlusconi tried to do this. He failed to do this, but he failed also because the Northern League was against, because part of the electorate of the Northern League was working class. Coming, by the way, also from the left, in the sense that there was a shift of votes from the left to the Northern League. So this is why they decided to withdraw their support. The other element that determined the fall of Berlusconi was a popular mobilization, in the sense that the unions organized a general strike and 2 days of mobilization. And with a demonstration in Rome in November with a million people. And this was one of the biggest demonstrations ever organized by unions. So this also contributed to the crisis of the government.
But then the successor government managed to accomplish the pension reform that Berlusconi couldn't.
Exactly. So this the successive government was a technocratic government that was nominated with the support of the center-left. And he did manage to actually carry out a terrible reform of the pension system, which opened the way, by the way, to a series of subsequent reforms, because this was not the only reform. The pension system has been cut and reshaped over the course of two decades. And then after this technocratic government, there were new elections with the victory of the center-left.
The success of this pension reform, the unions signed on to it, right?
Yeah.
And this was all in the name of preventing the return of Berlusconi?
Exactly. So this was the beginning of the disaster, in the sense that the unions didn't really oppose this reform. And also they didn't really oppose the further neoliberal austerity reforms carried out by the center-left government. So for example, the reform of the labor law, which introduced for the first time a massive casualization of work. They did not oppose this.
This kind of centrist technocratic government that also managed the run-up to the creation of the euro?
Yes.
So they were imposing the fiscal standards of Maastricht and
exactly.
Austerity and hard money and all that.
All this was accepted. Not only was actually the center-left was the most Europeanist force in the parliament, in the sense, but actually until 2011 Berlusconi was a Europeanist too. This is another difference with Trump, that is not Berlusconi has never been an isolationist. Unfortunately, also the unions and in general center-left voters tended to take a very strong position in favor of the European the creation of the Eurozone, which of course caused enormous damages to the Italian economy and to the living standards of the Italian working class.
I'm speaking with Cinzia Oruzza, who teaches philosophy at the New School.
Now, I know that some countries in Southern Europe, and I learned this when I was in Portugal a few years ago, that people supported the EU because it seemed like a way of getting out of a certain degree of isolation, but also the corruption and incompetence of the government. Was there anything like that operating in Italy?
Yeah, probably there was this element too, that there was, let's say, the fantasy that the way things are managed in Europe is better, more transparent or less corrupt. And there was, I think what really had an effect was the idea of, you know, the free circulation of people across, well, European citizens across across Europe, the possibility of studying or working in other European countries. And also the euro, the creation of the eurozone was presented actually as a way to strengthen the economy. So in other words, the idea was that by creating the eurozone, one would create a geopolitical pole incapable of competing on equal terms with the United States, for example. So there was also this fantasy of the euro, about the euro creating prosperity.
Okay, now back to Berlusconi. How did he make a comeback?
He made a comeback actually after 5 years of center-left government, which is something that center-left voters in Italy, anti-Berlusconi voters in Italy tend to forget. So there were five long years of center-left government, which carried out a series of austerity neoliberal reforms. For example, the Prodi government accomplished the greatest privatization of public companies and assets in Europe in terms of quantity of capitals mobilized. As I said, the labor market was reformed. There was the introduction of the autonomy of schools and universities. That was basically the introduction of the principle of corporate-style form of management of public schools and universities. By the way, it was the center-left government that actually created for the first time with the new immigration law, for the first time created the detention centers for migrants. So the outcome of 5 years of this kind of policies, coupled, by the way, with the participation of Italy in the bombing of Serbia, in my view, really seriously contributed to strengthening Berlusconi. In other words, there was clearly a shift of voters from the center-left, working class voters from the center-left to the center-right. And this was due to the serious worsenings of the conditions of life in the country. So in other words, the center-left didn't really show to be an alternative for working people. So I think that the 5 years of continuous austerity with no virtual opposition, in the sense that there was a right-wing opposition, of course, there was a partial opposition coming from the Communist Party, Rifondazione Comunista, but there was no real opposition, social opposition in the streets, for example. Only the radical left kept organizing mobilizations and demonstrations, but, for example, the unions did not mobilize their members. Precisely because they didn't want to give the opportunity to Berlusconi to come back. And this actually had as an outcome that Berlusconi came back much stronger than he was.
And when did he come back?
2001.
What did he do in office? What was what were the characteristics of his longer-term government?
So from 2001 to 2006, he continued the politics of the center-left, making them worse. So, for example, he had a very aggressive anti-immigration politics, but the new immigration law voted by the Berlusconi government is actually just an amendment of the previous immigration law, so which means that the basic structure of the law was maintained. The government continued privatizing public services on a municipal level. They carried on a reform of university, and they also tried to carry on a constitutional reform. Actually, the center-left government tried this too. They failed because the reform was rejected at the referendum. And of course, they were responsible for the participation in the Iraq and Afghanistan war. But at the same time, one should remember that actually it was the center-left that started Italy's participation in wars.
A lot of this sounds rather familiar.
Yes.
To an American. And I imagine the center left at this point was saying, not offering much in the way of a positive alternative, but just saying, we're not Berlusconi.
Exactly. Actually, the center left in that. So there was a split that actually I'm seeing happening in the States now, in the sense that on the one hand, there was this anti-Berlusconism that was precisely agitating this slogans about Berlusconi being a fascist, being this being the end of democracy, everything is better than Berlusconi and so on, which is quite similar to a certain form of anti-Trumpism. On the other hand, the center-left in parliament actually always carried on a politics, let's say, of compromise with Berlusconi. As I said, during 5 years of government, they didn't pass a law on the conflict of interest that would have actually really seriously damaged Berlusconi. They refused to do this. They tried to create constitutional reform with Berlusconi. And also during the Berlusconi's government, in the end, you know, whenever it was possible to cooperate, they did it. So there was a complete split between anti-Berlusconi rhetoric that was agitated, and then the actual behavior and political choices of the center-left parties in parliament that actually contradicted this anti-Berlusconi hysteria, in a certain sense.
I recall in your Verso blog piece, you expressed some skepticism about calling Trump a fascist. Do you think there's anything helpful or accurate about that label?
No, I really don't believe so. Actually, by the way...
Why not? What do you think?
First of all, I mean, it depends, of course, on how we define fascism. But if we want the term to have some significance besides being an insult addressed to right-wing and authoritarian politicians, then there are some elements that that should be taken into account. Fascism is based, in any case, on a mobilization of masses, which is not taking place in the States. Trump is, at the moment, just an electoral phenomenon. And also, you know, comparisons between... Trump and Hitler that I've read don't take into account the fact that Hitler didn't just win an election. His electoral victory was prepared by the creation of a rather militarized party and by years and years of fights on the streets against union members and social democratic activists and so on. So already there is not this element. Trump is just an electoral phenomenon. There is no mass mobilization around him. And secondly, you know, some elements that are key to fascist ideology are not present in Trump. Yes, Trump is a nationalist of some sort, but this is not sufficient to call him a fascist. Also, I would say that the problem I see with this definition is that, as in the case of Italy, if we define, let's say, the politicians like Berlusconi and Trump that who carry on some form of authoritarian neoliberal populism, if we define them as fascism, then of course the immediate reaction is to say that, okay, then actually everything is better than this, in the sense that yes, then we should ally with all democratic forces to fight this danger, because democracy is really in danger and so on. And I think that this is detrimental. This is what happened in Italy. The mantra that Berlusconi was a fascist actually justified accepting every possible neoliberal and austerity politics, and also anti-migrant policies and war and so on. So I would say that it is even detrimental for the left to insist on this point of a danger of fascism.
Well, this is a good segue to the closing question then. What would you say the Berlusconi experience teaches or should teach Americans about how to respond to Trump?
So first of all, precisely try to drop this kind of demonization. Not in the sense, I want to not to be misunderstood. In other words, I do think that we need to actually work on a very strong social opposition to Trump, and that Trump is a danger. But I do think that by creating this fantasy of the end of American democracy, fascism coming to power, and so on, I think we are actually not addressing the real causes, some parts of the real causes of Trump's victory. In other words, clearly Trump's victory was in part due to the fact that there is still in the States a sector of the population that is deeply racist and sexist, and that was galvanized by his rhetoric. But there is also an element of his victory that has to do with the fact that probably people are not willing to accept anymore the kind of neoliberalism that has been imposed upon them. And we need to address this point. So one thing I would say is that without addressing the causes, so without having a very clear anti-austerity, anti-neoliberal politics and program, it is not possible to stop this kind of phenomenon. Actually, we are going to strengthen it. So what I would do personally is to work at the moment on the creation of very large social coalitions, working on the opposition to Trump on issues that go from environment to the minimum wage, to the prison system, to the deportation of migrants and so on, but keeping really a serious autonomy from the Democratic Party. So without falling into the logic of lesser ableism, which, by the way, has never really worked.
That was Cinzia Urruzza, an assistant professor of philosophy at the New School. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some of Reagan hysteria, a piece of 1983 Italian hardcore by Fallout. Till next week, bye.